Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Daytona Beach International Airport, offering new nonstop service to New York City and Boston, Massachusetts. Daytona Beach International Airport features convenient access to the terminal, easy and close parking, and more. Details at flydab.com.
Ah, but I was so much older then. I'm younger than that now.
Welcome into Growing Boulder. I'm Mark Middleton. Coming up on today's program, the inspiring A. Lua Arthur, America's leading death doula. But don't let that scare you away, because she is all about living and her insight is profound. Also, are you a caregiver? Are you concerned about needing care? Are you concerned about being able to provide or pay for care? Well, it's a concern for nearly every family in America these days. The age wave is here, and we've reached what many are now calling crisis mode, where the cost and the effort of caring for older Americans has become unsustainable. We'll speak with Sean Bloom, the CEO of an organization that believes it might have a solution. And we'll hear from Growing Boulder contributor Cecily Wilson on the power and importance of being an encourager. You know, folks, here at Growing Boulder, we say that we are in the business of rebranding aging from a time of loss and limitation to one of passion and purpose and possibility. We choose to not mourn what's lost, but to celebrate what remains, to not regret growing older, but to be grateful for it. But of course, we can't ignore the reality of our mortality. Unfortunately, though, that is exactly what most of us do. You know, I've surprised many people by saying that I actually enjoy a thought-provoking conversation about death, because that can inform how we live. But unless you're in hospice care, it's really not a conversation that many people are willing to engage in, which is why I'm excited to speak with today's guest, because that is her business and nobody does it better. A. Lua Arthur is a death doula. Her mission is to help us understand that embracing death can actually lead to a more meaningful life. And sure, it's easier said than done in our ageist culture that doesn't want to think about dying, much less talk about it. But that is the exact impact that she's having, the conversation that she's creating, and we are all so much better for it. Her TED Talk is called Why Thinking About Death Helps You Live a Better Life. It is uplifting and considered by many to be one of the very best TED Talks of all time. She's the founder of Going with Grace, a death doula training and end-of-life planning organization, and her new memoir, Briefly, Perfectly Human, Making an Authentic Life by Getting Real About the End, is now drawing rave reviews from both critics and readers alike. A. Lua Arthur is on the road today, but joins us from New York City. A. Lua, thank you so much for your time, because I know how busy you are.
It's my absolute pleasure and honor to be here. Thank you for having me.
I am so jacked up to have this conversation. Before we get into your philosophy about life and death and what led you to this calling, would you define death doula for us? So what is your job?
Absolutely. A death doula is a non-medical and holistic support person for the dying person and their circle of support through the process. That means no matter where anybody is in the life cycle, we can support them once they come into recognition of their mortality. So when people are healthy, we can help them complete comprehensive end-of-life plans and work through all of their thoughts and fears and concerns, anxieties about dying. When somebody knows what it is that they're going to be dying of, we can support them in creating the most ideal death for themselves under the circumstances. And then after a death, we can help family members wrap up affairs of their loved one's life, which means that we are doing all practical, emotional, and spiritual support around death and dying.
Man, and what a need we have always, but certainly in this culture today. And you know, we always talk about life being filled with unexpected transitions. And you didn't go to school to become a death doula. You were an attorney in Los Angeles, and by your own admission, suffering from severe depression when you took some time off. You traveled to Cuba, a trip that ultimately changed your life. Can you tell us about the trip and about Jessica?
So happy to do so. I met Jessica in line to get a ticket to get to Santiago de Cuba. I was in Trinidad, Cuba. And Jessica and I started chatting about a tattoo that she had. And ultimately, she saved me a seat on the bus because I was late. And once I sat down, we started chatting about what we were both doing in Cuba. And she shared that she was on a trip to see the top six places in the world she wanted to see before she died because she had uterine cancer. That created a space for us to be really thoughtful about our mortality and also to find ways for us to think about how planning for death can support us in living the life that we want. I learned a lot about her mortality, the conversation that she hadn't been having with many people in her life. And then beyond that, I also started to think about my own mortality and started to think about my disease of depression and how I was going to engage with my life, given the fact that one day I'd die from my disease. It was a really meaningful and thought-provoking conversation. It was the first one of its kind that I'd had. And I learned a lot in that moment and have continued the conversation about mortality ever since then.
You know, we are, to some extent, I think, products of the lives that we've lived. And, you know, your family fled a murderous coup d'etat in Ghana back in the 1980s. You were an unhappy practicing attorney in Los Angeles. As you noted, you suffered serious bouts of depression. You've lost loved ones, and yet you somehow developed a relationship with your own mortality that seems to be joyful, uplifting, and even humorous, if anyone has heard you talk. How has your difficult background informed who you are today?
It's given me a lens through which to view my life. Once I fully understand that this life that I'm living is absolutely precious, that every day that I get to live is an utter gift, it allows me to engage with the world in a way that reflects that, where I can be present for this life that I lead, the fact that I get to breathe air and spend time with people that I love and do work that I find meaningful. That to me is a gift, and it's a way that we can all view our lives, which allows us to reach the end feeling satisfied with the lives that we actually had.
So let's get into it a little bit, because you say there is a death phobia in today's culture, in today's society. I think that that's obvious. What are the consequences of this death phobia? And given that we really can't choose the time or the circumstances of our death, why should we even think about it at all?
Well, the death phobia, I think, is something that we learn in society through a result of religion or our own egoic sense of self that places ourselves at the very center of everybody's story and cannot imagine life going on without us. And that death phobia often means that people don't spend the time thinking about the fact that one day they'll die, which means they don't use their death to inform their life. To me, death is our absolute greatest teacher. It can tell me exactly what I value, how I want to spend my time, what of me I'll leave behind, how I want to engage with the world and the people that I love. And so being in a practice of sitting with mortality allows us to be really present with our lives so that we can reach the end, not prepared, but rather just ready for whatever comes next, if there is anything at all, and be satisfied with what we did while we were here.
You know, maybe a bad way to describe it, but you have had a front row seat to, you know, to countless deaths. And I've had conversations with people who work in hospice care who have described a good death. And I was, it put me back on my heels. And I said, wait a second, what's a good death? What is a good death? I'm sure you've seen some. And I know we've got to be lucky to some extent and not be hit by a bus or something. But what constitutes a good death, and how can we help increase the odds that we might have one?
Well, I think the good death really depends on the individual, because for some, getting hit by a bus, having no awareness that their death is coming and just be gone in an instant is their idea of a good death. A good death largely relates to a good life. I try to take the judgment out of how people die, because it creates compound grief for the people afterward if they think that their loved one died a bad death. And so a good death is up to us to define, but it's really informed by how we live. I think no matter how I meet my end, if I have lived my life in accordance with my values, if I've been as authentic as possible, then when I reach the end, for whatever that end is, then that will mean that ultimately it was a good one. I do want to say, however, that there are thousands, millions of people that die in all types of ways that none of us would wish on our worst enemies. And that to me does feel like bad deaths. And yet, if we can bring some sanctity, some sacredness, some honor to the life that they lived and thus the death that they died, to me, then it will be a good death.
We're speaking with Alua Arthur, folks, who is, I'm sure she doesn't care about titles, but now universally considered America's top death doula, someone that is truly changing the conversation, trying to get us all to understand our mortality and look at our death as a way to inform how we live. And Alua, we obviously live in what may be the most commercialized consumer culture of all time. I think our self-worth becomes entangled in things and in success as defined by culture. And in your book, you say that the key is to absolve ourselves of the responsibility of having some grand life purpose and to live authentically. How do you define living authentically? How can we do more of that?
I think it requires us to get really, really clear about who we want to be while we're living. We learn so much about who we should be from society, from our parents, from religion, from culture. And that places a big burden on us to live up to those expectations. And yet when I can define success for myself, be absolutely clear about what success means, then I can know whether or not I've reached it. When I'm living in relationship to the external pressures, then first of all, I don't think I'm living very authentically. And next, I'm always going to fail. I found myself in that position practicing law. I had gone to law school and was doing my best to make everybody in my life proud of me, to do work that felt really good to my spirit. And yet I felt empty. I felt as though I was not living truly the way that I wanted to. There are parts of me that I had to shut down in order to engage in that work that way. And that's not something I wish on anybody. I wish that we all had an opportunity to do the work that we felt good about, to be in our relationships the way that feel good, to be expressed in our bodies the way that feel authentic for us, because that's what we're going to have to reconcile as we die.
And it is tragic that so many people never really figure that out, and then others too late. And, you know, I'm sure you have, you know, seen occasionally a hospice nurse will share the top three regrets of people who are dying. From your experience, what are the top regrets and what have you learned from that that you can share with us?
The one that I can take away most strongly is folks feeling as though they have regret over how they showed up in life, not living authentically, not being true to themselves. I hear that one time and time again. And that's the one that often breaks my heart, because often when people start to recognize that, they are near the end and there isn't any time to course correct. I also hear people talking often about wishing that they would have spent their time differently, either more with their kids or less with their kids, more doing hobbies and activities that felt good and nourished their spirit, more time with friends. I often hear people wishing that they had more time. And the question always I think of is, more time for what? What else would you do with your time that you haven't yet done? But often that comes up when death catches people by surprise, when they hadn't spent any time considering their mortality and such, they're wishing that they had more to do, something that they didn't do with the time that they had.
Is it true that you espouse a message to some extent of taking chances? I mean, we do become more risk averse as we get older. And you know, I'm not talking about the kind of risks that are going to, you know, risk our health and well-being, but the risk of embarrassment, the risk of failure, the risk of unease. Is that something that death can help us learn about the way to live our life?
100%. I also often hear people wish that they would have taken more chances. Wish that they would have said, I love you to somebody, or wish they would have quit a job earlier, or wish that they would have had the courage to say something that they need to their parents or come out, or there's a number of things that people regret. I'm also finding myself taking less chances as I get older, but those are more because I want to like preserve my body. You know, I won't ride one of these scooters down the street because I care about my kneecaps. I don't want to break all my teeth. When I was 18, I probably didn't care, but at 45, I care far more than I did then.
What's it like, I mean, being immersed in the topic of death? And, you know, especially for someone who admittedly has had problems with depression, do sometimes you worry about your own mental health and well-being because you see so much death, or does it truly inspire you and keep you motivated?
It inspires me. Being around dying is the most life-affirming thing I know how to do. When around somebody who knows that their life will soon be ending, to see how they are with the people that they care about and people that love them, the time that they've had, people become so much more of themselves as they lay dying. And I don't want to paint it like roses and butterflies, because people become more of themselves, which means the good and the difficult. And so being around people that are dying consistently, being around death, seeing a body not long after life has left it, reminds me that I am still animated by that intangible something that allows me to engage with the world in a way that feels good to me. And it reminds me constantly to live and to be present and to be grateful for this gift that I have of life.
And if one has prepared, and I would imagine, and I have no idea, but I would imagine this, I don't want to say onslaught of dementia, but dementia is a big issue in our elder population. So putting that aside, you know, personally, I always say, man, I'm going to fight like hell. I'm going to fight as hard as I can, as long as I can. But at some point, you know, if we're not hit by a bus, you know, I hope I realize it's time to surrender. And I've been told that when older people or anybody, you know, reaches that stage where they have fought, they fought the good fight, they've said the things that need to be said, and they do surrender, almost a sense of peace comes over them, and they become curious and intrigued about what's next. Have you experienced that? Is there this point after surrender where it's really not all bad?
Absolutely. I think surrender is the sweetest spot for any of us while we live, when we finally let go so tightly to control and we allow life to do what it will and allow death to do what it will. I found that surrender in the dying process means that people finally take the invitation into their I'm sorry's and I love you's and wow, what a ride this was. How lucky I was to experience this for a while. And that's what I want for all of us while we're still living, which is part of why I'm trying so hard to get the message out there about living in relationship with mortality, because that's the real gift it creates.
In a world that is obsessed with discovering the keys to immortality, Alua Arthur is helping us all appreciate the many life-enriching gifts of mortality. Of course, the biggest question of all is, what happens when we die? That's a transition that Arthur has helped thousands make, and when we return, I'll ask her that very question, what's next? This is Growing Bolder.
Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts.
Welcome back to Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton. We are talking today with Alua Arthur, America's top death doula, a non-medical support person who pretty much like a midwife helps with the birthing process, helps individuals and families with the dying process. And I couldn't have a conversation with Arthur without asking her thoughts on what's next. What happens when we die?
I don't yet know what happens after we die, and I don't know that I want to. Something about the mystery of it all is really intriguing to me. And yet what we do generally is we fill it with so much dread and fear. And we do that consistently when we're thinking about death. And yet when we're in our regular lives and we are thinking about the unknown or we're thinking about a trip that we might take, we generally anticipate it joyfully, even though we don't yet know what it is that we'll meet. We imagine a beautiful thing or imagine having a really good time. And I think the same is available if we think about our death and what comes after we die, if anything at all, the same way. Then we have the opportunity to create something that feels good to us rather than something that's like scary and dreadful and awful. None of us know. Why not fill it with glitter and sunshine, rainbows?
I love that. Let's talk for just a moment, if we can, about the practical, the pragmatic side of preparing for death. What should we all be doing that probably most of us are not?
I think really simply, the most important thing to do is to complete something called an advance directive, which is a document that clearly states out your desires for life support or any treatment at the end of your life, in addition to designating a person, a medical decision maker or a medical power of attorney who's going to carry out those decisions. I think that's the single most important thing for us to do. And then it's important to talk about the type of care we want to receive, in addition to think about our body and its disposition. Any services we may want, to consider our possessions. Yes, it is wildly important to have a will, but it's also important for us to think about our sentimental items and what the story behind those items is and what we want done with it after we die. We also must think about our dependents, any adult disabled people that are in our care or children or our pets. You must gather important biographical information and data like birth certificates and death decrees and deeds and leases and bank account details and passwords. Think about our online lives. Think about all the passwords that we need to navigate the world on the internet, at least. And then also really important to think about our ideas around living and dying and anything that we want to pass on to future generations.
Wow. I don't know how much you know about Growing Bolder, if anything, but I like to say, and prove me wrong if you can, we've done more interviews with active centenarians than any media company in the world. And, you know, we always just try to get to know them and see what keeps them going. And I think one of the lessons that we learn is that obviously the older we get, that less is more. And the most valuable things in our lives are relationships. And so many centenarians have told us when we ask them what's important, and they say, you know, it's simply observing life's little miracles. And they say that while they enjoy life, without exception, they all say that they have no fear of death. Can we all get there? Is it possible to reach a point when we no longer fear death?
Well, I think it's tricky. I think for many centenarians in particular, or folks that have been around for a while, do whittle down life to its most important and essential details and information and joy. I think a healthy fear of death is built into many of us. It's the thing that tells us to stop walking when we get to the edge of a cliff, or to run the other direction when we hear a really loud noise, the mechanism that makes all the hair stand up on the back of your neck when there's danger approaching. And so a little bit of fear of death is built into us. I think it becomes challenging when we try to either get rid of it altogether, or that fear of death becomes crippling and it's informing how we're living. If we're holding back on life somehow because we're afraid to die, that's when it needs some attention. Yet we can learn from our fear of death. When I think about the things that I still fear, it allows me to see really what I value and to spend more time in that direction.
You are obviously the voice that we need right now. I mean, incredibly authentic and articulate. But you know, as a culture, we've obviously branded death as very, very dark. I mean, the Grim Reaper, always clothed in black. And I actually Googled death fonts. I don't know why, but I thought death fonts. I'm sure there's something in there. So I Googled death fonts this morning, and it was exactly what I expected. It was dark. It was sinister. It was dripping with whatever. And, you know, as you're reframing dying, how much putback do you get pushback from death doula? Is that the best description about what you do? Are you concerned about that? How do you rebrand death?
You're right. Death does need a PR makeover. And I hope I'm helping somehow.
No, you are.
I hope so. My hope is that as we remove ourselves from that like dark and scary and heavy element of dying, don't get me wrong, I understand grief and sadness and loss, and it's difficult and it's scary not to engage with the unknown. But as we allow ourselves a little bit of space to have it be something else, to feel grateful for the lives that we had rather than the fear, I think that that will naturally start to rebrand death. I think as more of us are engaging with our mortality and we see the benefits that it creates for ourselves to do so, slowly, certainly, the needle will start to shift in that direction. And this podcast and what you're doing today is certainly supporting us and moving it a little bit closer to an opportunity to embrace our death rather than to fear it.
Are you sensing that things are changing? I mean, in our business, we're always talking about when the heck is the tipping point going to occur where, you know, corporate America understands the value of the demographic that we create content for. There was no one like you a decade ago, and there wasn't the media platforms that exist now that enable your voice to, you know, be magnified. Also, in addition to getting positive affirmation, I'm guessing it's an opportunity for people to, you know, to push back. I mean, do you feel like this is a conversation that we can actually have as a culture?
Absolutely. I'll tell you what, 10 years ago is when I started my practice, and there were people doing the work. I think death doulas and folks doing death work have been around since time immemorial, because as long as people have been living, people have been dying and other people have been supporting them through it. I appreciate using the term death doula because it calls it exactly what it is. Culture is shifting. The fact that platforms are available for us to talk about death, the fact that my book hit the New York Times bestseller list as a death centered conversation tells me that things are shifting, and I am beside myself about the fact that folks are opening up to it. Just one last thing I want to share. often when I tell people the work that I'm doing, one of three things happens. Either they lean in and tell me that they wish that I was there when their mother, brother, father, sister, aunt, pet turtle was dying, or they will want to throw around ideas about what happens after we die, or they will just say, huh, that's interesting, and pretend I don't exist for the rest of the time because they're too afraid of it. But even with the folks that turn away, I think a seed has been planted, and the seed of our mortality is an absolute gift, because when it is carefully tended, life can spring up in its place. Things are starting to shift, and I'm so grateful it's starting to shift. We're going to reduce needless suffering that people have around how we die, and hopefully take care of each other a little bit better through the process.
Well, thank you for mentioning your book again, because I was going to ask you, even if we are willing to have a conversation about death ourselves, having it with someone else is entirely different. How would we start that conversation? But, folks, here's the answer. It is your book. I mean, this really is, I think, the perfect answer to that conversation. This book is profound. It's interesting. It's got pace. It's got intrigue. It's a memoir about an amazing life and an amazing woman who is, helping us all come to grips with one of life's most important questions. So, let me ask you this before we let you go. What's the lesson? I mean, what's the moral of the story? And maybe it doesn't have to have anything to do with death, but I imagine it would. What have you learned about life in general, Alua, that you wish all of us knew?
I wish we could all sink in deep to what a gift it is to be alive, no matter the circumstances of our life. It takes dizzying, dizzying odds to be born, to get to experience like the first drops of rain or the bite in your jaw when you first bite into an orange, or even to be able to look somebody that you love in the eye and be present in your life. That is an utter gift, and it's precious. It is fleeting. Our death often comes sooner than we expect it to. And so why not sink into the gift that it is to be alive at this moment?
A death doula teaching us how to live. Folks, embracing death is the ultimate way of embracing life. So, don't wait for things to happen. Make them happen. Say yes. Lean into life. Alua Arthur, thank you so much for your time. And thank you especially for what you're doing, because you are making an important difference for all of us now and for many, many more moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This is my absolute pleasure and honor.
She is Alua Arthur. Her book is called Briefly, Perfectly Human. It's a guidebook for both how to live, but also how to die. You can learn more about her and her work at her website, goingwithgrace.com. When we return, America's caregiving crisis and the new model of care that every family in America needs to know about. This is Growing Bolder.
Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts.
Welcome back to Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton. At Growing Bolder, we are most definitely glass half full kids. We choose to look at aging through a prism of possibility, and not simply loss and limitation. We know that more is possible than our ageist culture would lead us to believe, because we tell stories every day of ordinary people who are living extraordinary lives into their 80s, their 90s, and even their 100s. And while we choose to celebrate extra years, we can't ignore the reality that for many, there are significant challenges. The numbers don't lie. 10,000 Americans are now turning 65 every day. 70% will likely need long-term care, and 37% have no retirement savings at all, while the costs for care are soaring. There's also a widening care gap these days, more elderly parents needing care and fewer adult children to provide it. And of course, providing care for a loved one can cause serious health and financial problems for the caregiver. We've reached what many are now calling crisis mode, where the cost and the effort of caring for older Americans has become unsustainable. Is there a solution? Well, some say it could be a program that's called PACE, which is an acronym for Programs of All-Inclusive Care. Sean Bloom is the CEO of the nonprofit National PACE Association, and we've invited him to bring us up to speed on PACE. Sean, how you doing today?
Doing very well, and thank you very much for the opportunity to join you today.
You know, I love this conversation. People think at Growing Bolder, we want to ignore the reality of our mortality, but very much the opposite. I'll almost always feel like I have to offer a disclaimer that there is this other side that we need to talk about. You know, there can't be a stigma against talking about the challenges of aging. And before we, or you help us understand PACE, you know, tell me this, Sean, did I go to too dark of a place? Are we currently in the beginnings of what you think could be or is a senior care crisis?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it's interesting. I think the way you described it is probably more accurate than about anybody I've ever heard discuss this topic. There is, we often refer to it as there's kind of a cliff ahead of us here. When you look at the demographics alone, then you factor in the likelihood of individuals needing care and the income status of the growing cohort of people that will need that care. And the lack of, I think, financing resources around these individuals to pay for the care, we're really looking at some really tough times moving forward.
You know, you and I should be a tag team as we go out and speak. But I believe, given the resources that Growing Boulder has, that every senior care organization should, to some extent, be trying to modify the lifestyle of younger adults so that we can try to get some sort of handle on this age wave of frail and fragile elderly that are coming toward us. That's where I like to talk about. You're talking about dealing with the folks that are in that age wave. And I think both sides of the equation are critically important. So other than an acronym, what is PACE? How long have you guys been around and what are you doing?
Yeah, we are in many ways, and we don't really wear this with pride, but I think we're probably one of the best kept secrets in aging care. We've been around, believe it or not, since probably the late 80s and early 90s. We originated in San Francisco as a solution for a group of individuals in Chinatown that really wanted to find a more common sense approach to take care of their loved ones outside of a nursing home. So over the years, PACE was kind of tested, experimented, studied, and then finally in 1997, Congress added this as a permanent Medicare benefit and an optional Medicaid state plan service option. So we are, when individuals enroll in PACE, we are kind of care made simple. We organize and deliver all needed primary, acute, and long-term care services. And what really changes the nature of how we go about addressing individuals' care needs is how we get paid. We don't bill for every little thing we do. We get one lump sum per month. And with that money, we need to really get thoughtful about how best to meet individuals' needs. And that approach really has led to, we've got about 70,000 people today across the country that are receiving services from PACE, and only about 5% are permanently placed in a nursing home. So we've got a very good 20-year track record of delivering very good care, very high satisfaction, and extraordinary support for caregivers of individuals we serve.
If I'm understanding it, Sean, it seems like it may be the ultimate win-win, because it sounds like you are providing the kind of care, and I mean all of the care that one might get in a nursing home, but for most of the people you serve, you are providing that care in their own home. Is that right?
Yeah, and most of our services are organized in the PACE Center. It's also important to note that we're not just here to help individuals stay out of the nursing home. We manage all their pharmaceutical needs. We manage all their primary care. We have to be thoughtful about everything because we are at financial risk for hospital services and essentially all Medicare and medically necessary services. So it is in our best interest to be incentivized to make sure individuals' health needs are addressed proactively, completely, and consistently over time so that they don't end up in a hospital and don't end up in a nursing home when we can just address those up front.
Is this an example of what's called value-based care as opposed to fee-for-service?
Yes, that is probably a little bit more accessible term. I think it's technically we are paid under capitation, which is a lump sum, but value-based care. And I think your point about We call it aligned incentives. In PACE, the delivery of good care equates to good outcomes, both for the PACE organization, for the individual we serve, and for the government, because we save money. So it's really a win-win-win.
You've been around, like you said, since the 80s, but talk a little bit about the pandemic, if you will, and how it might have, you know, impacted not just the services you provide, but the population's desire for those services, because it seems like the pandemic was a major turning point in the senior care industry. Fair to say, many nursing homes did not fare well during the pandemic. Many people don't want to go to nursing homes now. There's fewer beds than there used to be. And as we said in the introduction, there's not a lot of people that want to work in nursing homes. What is the status of that industry right now? And how has that impacted what PACE does?
Yeah, very, very good question. You know, leading up to the pandemic, you know, I think as a society, in particular, federal and state governments, they were becoming much more effective at what we refer to as rebalancing the system, which is essentially giving people more non-institutional or nursing home options to choose from. And so, but that was moving rather slowly, and I don't think it was keeping pace with what consumers really were wanting and demanding, kind of under the give me what I want to buy, not what you have to sell banner. But the pandemic, unfortunately, I think cast a very significant light on the need to support the emergence of new community-based options. And we're not talking about the traditional ones that have always been there, like home care and other things, but really models of care like PACE, which really consider the full spectrum of individuals' needs in the home, in the community. Again, primary care, nursing home care if needed, hospital care if we need to do that, and really looking at the whole person. But I think due to a change of consumer attitudes, a lot of incentives by the federal government for states to really support the emergence of new options, we are growing very, very significantly now.
So who is PACE for? I mean, how many people are eligible for PACE benefits? I know you told us how many people you serve, but I'm guessing that's just a small percentage of those who might be eligible. And why aren't more people taking advantage of PACE services?
Very good question again. I think in our estimates, we're serving roughly 1% of people that could qualify and be eligible and benefit from PACE. You know, the system has really been set up, I think, to allow individuals to choose either health plans or what I call institutional services, or maybe some home and community-based services. It's really not set up well, I think, to encourage people to enroll in comprehensive coordinated care models like PACE. That's changing. We're beginning to see that. It's also important to note that I mentioned that we are an optional Medicaid benefit. So we truly exist at the pleasure of the states, not only whether we exist at all, but how big our programs can grow. Now, having said that, some states, Florida, California, I could go on, have done a very good job really supporting the expansion and availability of PACE. But we still have a handful of states that have not offered PACE, so it's not available to individuals that can benefit from it.
So how can that be changed? Because I'm guessing people that are listening to us right now that think, wow, PACE sounds good for me. I mean, the individual is not going to change it. Will it take some sort of legislation? Is there anything in the works?
Yeah, I think one of the most important things that we're doing is we're constantly encouraging states to move forward. And in many states, that does require the passage of legislation. But I think more importantly, and probably more effectively, I think individuals, consumers, need to really kind of speak to their elected officials about, I want some options like PACE in my market, in my community. And I think it's going to be the consumer voices that really help to propel PACE and expand its access throughout the country.
And I did read this, getting ready to speak with you. Folks, if you want a recommendation about PACE, here's a pretty good one. 97.5% of all caregivers recommend PACE. I mean, the folks that are in the industry understand that it does well. So if I understand this, Sean, PACE programs help people address their health care needs, whatever they might be, while for the most part staying at their home instead of a nursing care facility. And PACE programs, in addition to helping people in their homes, they're based in communities that also have PACE community centers or PACE centers. What's that about? What's that like?
Yeah, you know, and it's probably important in answering that question to begin with. In the middle of the PACE program is what's called an interdisciplinary team. An interdisciplinary team can be thought of and is defined by regulations, but it's we directly employ physicians, nurses, social workers, physical therapists, occupational therapists, home care professionals, transportation professionals, dietitians, essentially the full range of the type of individuals that provide the services that older adults often need when they grow older. They are directly employed. They meet every day in the PACE Center, and they perform a few functions. One, they do a comprehensive assessment of individuals' needs that's unique to each individual. They put together care plans that are specific to the needs of each individual. And then they monitor and track the delivery of those services to see how people respond. That's all within the day center, but there's also areas of the day center for recreation, nutrition, physical therapy. There's medical clinic. In many PACE centers, there's a pharmacy. So it's really the hub of really the PACE model of care that extends out into the community and the individual's homes.
So you mentioned 72,000 people now being served by PACE, give or take, but more than 2 million people in the U.S. are eligible. And folks, people in the PACE program have no co-pays and no deductibles, as I understand it. Is that true, Sean?
Yeah. If an individual chooses to elect in PACE, they will pay an out-of-pocket fixed amount each month. And that does not change based on their evolving needs. And what that does, that may sound a little counterintuitive to people that are used to writing a check for every discrete service they use. But what it says to us is we've got very strong incentives to really be proactive in identifying and addressing individuals' existing and emerging healthcare needs in a manner which can mitigate or altogether eliminate the need for nursing home care and hospital use.
Honestly, from your perspective, Sean, is this an answer to what is a care crisis? Could PACE be part of the solution moving forward?
Yes. I mean, I will say I grew up working in nursing homes as a nurse aide. I went to kind of undergraduate and graduate school to study aging. My family's been involved in long-term care for years. And I thoroughly and honestly believe that this is the gold standard of care for America's seniors. And the outcomes prove it. The research demonstrates it. And I think if you talk to, most importantly, the people that are supported by PACE and their caregivers, very high rates of satisfaction.
Well, that's a great endorsement. So, Sean, tell us what people need to do. I mean, how can the people that are listening, A, help PACE grow and come to their state? Or how can they find out if it's in their state? And how can they find out if they're eligible? What do we do?
To be eligible for PACE, you have to be determined by the state. Each state has their own criteria to be eligible for a nursing home level of care. And that's typically some intersection between some cognitive issues and functioning, mobility, and medical issues. But I would check with each state to determine your eligibility. You have to be 55 years of age and older, and you have to live within the PACE service area, which is typically about 30 to 60 minutes drive time around the PACE Center. One way to find out if PACE is in your community would be to go to our website, which is www.npaonline.org. And there's a PACE finder. You can type in your zip code and find if there's a program nearby. That's certainly one way. And while you're there, I would definitely encourage consumers also to look at Before I Found PACE, which is a video series that we did where we taped the experiences of older adults and their families and what their experience has been in PACE. So that would be a way to kind of find PACE. I would definitely, if it's not in your community, I would talk to your state or elected officials and ask why not.
You know, folks, PACE is helping people meet all of their care needs while staying in their home instead of a nursing home or a caring facility. And we're talking about comprehensive medical care, social services. You know, Sean mentioned a physical site in the community that can provide adult daycare services. You know, Sean, this is the breath of fresh air, if you will, that I've needed when I do go to a dark place and I do look at these numbers of people that it's very easy to imagine a scenario in another 20 or 30 years where we are literally warehousing older adults who have very little quality of life. And it seems like PACE allows people to continue to have a quality of life as they age and as they encounter health problems.
Yeah, and one thing I would like to leave the audience as in kind of an example of our philosophy is we actually, the individuals we serve in PACE, we refer to as participants. And we say that because basically their preferences on how they want to age and grow older and receive care are really dictated by them and their families. So it is a model of care that definitely wraps itself around individuals, as opposed to the current system largely, where individuals have to fit in the defined set of services that are out there. It's a wonderful model of care. And I think for anybody that has an interest in growing old and having their preferences front and center and how they are served and cared for, PACE is really a good model for them.
Our thanks to Sean Bloom. And if you'd like to find out more about PACE Care, just go to npaonline.org. Coming up on Growing Bolder, the gift we can all give is encouragement. Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram for our latest stories, reels, and motivational memes.
Today, I don't have a word of encouragement, but a word about encouragement. Encouragement and nurturing from a loved one or even a total stranger can be the push necessary to help someone make a positive change in their life. And sadly, scorn and ridicule, even from a total stranger, can create enough fear and apprehension to paralyze someone's efforts and destroy their dreams. Too many people now define themselves simply by what they oppose, and what they oppose, in many cases, is simply that which someone else is for. So don't be a dream killer. When you see someone putting themselves out there, taking a chance, trying something new, encourage them, because that's growing bolder. I'm Cecily Wilson.
Thank you, Cecily Wilson, the power of a pat on the back. You know, if you ever feel like you can't make a difference, think about becoming an encourager, because encouragement has been proven to boost self-esteem, to enhance overall well-being, to promote mental and physical health by motivating others to stay active, to try new things, and to maintain social connections. It's easy to become an encourager. In fact, here's two simple ways to get started. Number one, celebrate efforts and achievements, no matter how small they might be. A simple, "I'm proud of you," or "That's amazing," for finishing a daily walk, trying a new recipe, or taking a new class can inspire older adults to keep striving. Be generous with heartfelt compliments. And number two, just be a good listener. Sometimes the most encouraging act is simply showing interest in their stories, their passions, and their challenges. Empathy and understanding validates their experiences. It makes them feel valued, and it deepens your relationship. So whether you realize it or not, you do have a superpower, the power to encourage, which is the power to change not just a life, but many lives, because encouragement creates a ripple effect. Those who are encouraged become encouragers themselves. We'll see you next time right here on Growing Bolder. And don't forget to check out our streaming channel, watch.growingbolder.com, and join the GB Revolution on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. We'll see you next time.
The Growing Bolder Radio Show is a production of Growing Bolder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Bolder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nannis. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.
Crimson flames tied through my ears, blowing high and mighty traps. Countless fire and flaming road, using ideas as my maps. We'll meet on edges soon, said I. So much older than, I'm younger than that now.
musketeers, foundation deep somehow. Oh, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. In a soldier's stance, I aim my hand at the mongrel dogs who teach. Fearing not, I'd become my enemy in the instant that I preach. Sisters fled by confusion boats, mutiny from stern to bow. Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. Too noble to neglect, deceive me.